Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com.
Hey gang, today's guest is Brendan Brown, lead vocalist and guitarist for the New York City rock band, Wheatus. Together, Brendan and I break down the writing, recording, and release of their mega hit from the turn of the century, Teenage Dirtbag, taken from their self-titled album in 2000. The influences Brendan listed behind the inspiration of the song are phenomenal. From LL Cool J to AC/DC to Soul Coughing, and about a dozen more artists were mentioned as influential markers that Brendan strived to hit with this track, and he did. For those reasons alone, that is why I feel this song absolutely stands on its own as being a one-of-a-kind, unique piece of music. In addition to that, the way the band layered the instrumentation and structured the production is another reason why the song is its own monster. Oh, and Brendan was beyond cool to offer up an exclusive, off-the-cuff acoustic rendition of the song for us here today. And he sounds exactly like he did 20 years ago. Amazing. For all this and 2 tickets to Iron Maiden, baby, don't touch that dial.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast.
Brendan, what's happening?
Hey, how are you?
I am fantastic. I want to thank you for sitting in today. You already told me you're in New York. Are you still in the city?
Yeah. We live in the Bronx now. We moved around New York City for the past, I don't know, 20, 25 years. I think I moved to the Lower East Side when I was about 25 and was down there for a minute. And then we went on tour and I didn't really have a place to come home to necessarily. That wasn't my mom's house, which was awkward. But then I moved a few years after that, 2004, I moved to Brooklyn. And I was in Brooklyn for a while, and then we moved to the Bronx. So
that's awesome. Looks like you're in your home studio there.
Yeah, we finally found a home where I can put all of this shit and stack it up.
Hey, honey, can I? No, please.
We do have that discussion. But Gabrielle, my life partner, plays guitar and is a singer songwriter as well, and we both ride BMX. So the BMXs are stacked up, the guitars are stacked up, the pedals are stacked up. It's kind of like, well, you sell something. No, you sell something. You know.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, in my notes here, I believe Gabrielle is one of your backup singers now for
That's
the band.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're keeping it all in the family. That's great. Well, for the listeners, I want to give a little history on Wheatus. The band was formed in 1995 in Northport, New York. I'm from Northport, Florida. Drastically different places.
Yeah. A little different. Yeah. Although there's a lot of New Yorkers, a lot of even Northport New Yorkers in Florida, and I'm sure quite a few who went to Northport, Florida.
Yeah. Florida's God's waiting room. That's where everyone from New York goes to die.
COVID purgatory.
Brendan is the only remaining founding member of Wheatus. He's the lead vocalist and guitarist of the band, and I guess you're commonly known to fans as how do you pronounce that? BBB or triple B or
BBB?
BBB.
Somebody said something recently that I had never heard. Somebody said, "Are you known as B3?" And I was like, "Never, not in any timeline." I hope.
Not unless you want to get punched.
Yeah, right.
the band was originally started with Brendan's brother
brother Peter on the drums and Rich Leahy on the bass. Multi-instrumentalist and engineer Phil A. Jimenez. Did I pronounce that right? Jimenez?
That's correct. Yeah, well, he pronounces it Jimenez.
He does. Okay.
He does. He does indeed. And I've gotten yelled at before, and I'm like, no, he's my friend. Trust me. So I don't know, you know.
Well, Phil joined the band after hearing Teenage Dirtbag, and he produced the self-titled Weedus album, which was mixed by, David Thoner?
Yeah, David Thoner, yeah.
Okay,
Who has some pretty interesting credits. I don't know if you looked him up, but I picked him for two. I saw two credits on his list when he came our way, and I knew it had to be him. It was for Those About to Rock. He had mixed that record, and he also mixed John Waite's Missing You, which is just an absolutely gorgeous piece of music. I thought, yeah, we need to sound exactly like whatever the two of them would be. You know?
Yeah, and Teenage Dirtbag is kind of right in the middle of both of those songs, I think.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I'm very proud of the work that Dave did on our first record. I think he nailed it. So he gave us we were working on our sound for a long time.
Yeah,
and he was like the punctuation mark at the end of that journey where it was like, no, this is what this band sounds like. And he really stuck the landing for us. So it was great.
That's great. Especially with your first record, you're trying to find who you are as a band. And that's pivotal a lot of times to finding your sound. That's great.
Of course, sounds like you know something about this yourself.
A little bit, Brennan, just a bit. The song we're going to be talking about, I kind of let the cat out of the dirt bag here a minute ago. It is Teenage Dirtbag. The band signed a multi-album deal with Columbia in 2000, and the self-titled album was released on August 15th, 2000. Teenage Dirtbag was their first and largest hit. It charted at number 2 in the UK and spent 4 weeks at number 1 in Australia, and the album has sold over 5 million copies worldwide. That is when I first heard of you. The single, I believe, was released in July, Brendan, and we were out on the road. And I remember where I was at. It's you know those moments. I'm sitting on the bus with Ben Osmondson, the bass player for Zebrahead. And
Ben, oh man.
Yeah, yeah. And we're sitting on the bus, and he goes, man, our label wants us to tour with that band, Weedus. He's like, we don't really know if we want to because like they're so different than us. We think we should be doing this. And I said, man, I said, they have the biggest song at alternative radio right now. I said, I'd probably take the tour. And I know they ended up doing the run with you. And
yeah, so I'll get this out right away. I love Ben. I love his whole band, all those guys.
They're great.
We learned so much from them, and they were super patient with us. And, you know, we were super green. But Ben was right. That tour was weird because it was a little misleading for the crowds. Like,
sure.
And it was a label thing where it's like, whatever the call numbers of the radio station, 102.3, you know, Cincinnati, that's how much the ticket costs, $1.02.
Right.
You know? So it was like this sort of like a kind of harebrainy idea. Now, Zebrahead had way more live experience than us and were really savvy and seasoned. And we were just kind of having our first tour. And there were all these conversations where I was like trying to get the label to roll it out slowly. Like, let's do a little East Coast thing and then come back home. Let's go do a little West Coast thing and come back home. And they were like, no, you're going on this huge radio promo tour with Zebrahead. And the thing was, you were right. We had this big song at alternative radio, and Zebrahead's single was clicking with their people big time on the audience level, but it wasn't happening at radio the way that Teenage Dirtbag was. So it was, we were on different schedules. Weedus was waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do Man Cow, you know?
Yeah.
And Zebrahead were still like up, you know, having a regular like tour where you go to bed at like 6 o'clock in the morning, you know? So it was like, and there was 21 people on that bus, on this like hockey bus. And they, as individuals, they were really exceptionally patient with what was going on and sort of gracious and and all that. But it was, we actually had conversations about in real time about how this is weird. Like, you know, what's going on?
Well, you know, and they were kind of trying to find who they were at that time. You know, they were out touring with my band, Less Than Jake. They were out touring, you know, taking any tours they could. And this came along, and Columbia was, you know, trying to invest in them, put some marketing dollars. But I'll tell you, Zebrahead, if you're listening, hello, guys. I love you. Top five bands we've ever toured with, have an absolute ball with them. And they're still out there killing it. Teenage Dirtbag was featured in films such as Loser and Bully, as well as the HBO miniseries Generation Kill, the Netflix original series Girl Boss, and the chilling adventures of Sabrina. The band began work on their second album in the summer of 2002. I love this story. The album's first single, American in Amsterdam, was heavily underpromoted after the band had a dispute with the label over their request to lip sync On Top of the Pops, which is an English music variety show. Sure. When their second album, Hand Over Your Loved Ones, was released in the fall of 2003, it received little to no promotion in the UK, and it was never released in the US. In October of 2004, the band parted ways with the label and re-released the album with a new title, Suck Phony.
So can I iron out the record a little bit here?
Yes, please iron it out.
Okay, so in the summer of 2001, we were booked to play with Stone Temple Pilots and Green Day at an Arctic Circle, a Finnish Arctic Circle festival, right? Meaning that the sun never sets. It's you can still take pictures of the sun at you know, in the sunlight at 12 midnight, and so you know the deal, right? So
yeah.
2 weeks before the festival, two things happened. Green Day and Stone Temple dropped off, I think, to go into treatment. And then the single, Teenage Dirtbag, really started hitting in Finland and the sort of Nordic region there, you know. And they asked us to take the headline slot after those two bands dropped off. What they didn't tell us was that it had become, or had originally been somewhat marketed as, a black metal festival.
Right? Yeah, of course, because you're up in that part of the world, you know?
Right.
Finnish black metal.
Right. And I love, like, give me all the stories about drinking out of skulls and all that stuff, you know, burning churches. I mean, like, it's real interesting to me, considering where I came from, where I grew up. But the fact was that we were like this sort of crossover pop or power pop band that was not supposed to be on that stage, really. Like, mm-hmm. if we're talking, you know. So about midway through the set, I got pelted with a rock that was like maybe half of a Belgian block, like about that much, like big. And this guy beamed me right in the chest while I was singing. And it kind of knocked the wind out of me and sent me back a little bit. And I was like in pain and pissed off. And I did the typical, like, green musician on tour for the first time in Europe thing, and I challenged the guy to a fight on stage. And up comes this, like, 7 foot tall Viking, right? And he's got like 4 or 5 security guards hanging off of him, you know, and he's fighting his way up, and he's on the barrier, and then all the barrier guards join in. So he's got like 10 guys trying to hold him back. Now, this guy would have ripped me in half, right? And I was kind of thinking, well, that's like, you know, that'll make the news. This guy actually kills me at a black metal festival. What a thing.
Might sell a few more records.
Right, exactly. So the thing that he was shouting in his sort of like best English was, "You suck, phony. You suck, phony," right?
Ah.
Right. So we had this idea even back then when we got off that stage and kind of regrouped backstage. We were cracking up about it, and we were kind of like, we have to put a live record out called Suck Phony. This is the you know, if that's not the thing that tells us to do that, what is? So that's where that title originally came from. It had very little to do with the record label.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I love that. And for those that don't know, that's known as a spoonerism, when you take the first letter and change it with the other word after it. I never knew that. My trombone player in my band, he enlightens me with weird, useless information that I'm sharing with everybody on the show right now.
Well, let's have a live taco, though, because when I finished writing Teenage Dirtbag, I lived in an apartment on Spooner Street.
There you go. The coincidences just keep rolling here.
Here we go.
The band continues to stay active today, touring and recording. They just finished up the Summerland tour with Everclear, Living Color, and Hoobastank, which I got to ask before we move on, how was that? That seems like a pretty cool bill.
Whoever said don't meet your heroes, that person lied. I'm borrowing that from, a Hoobastank tweet that was sort of like halfway through or almost all the way through the tour. Art Alexakis, one of my favorite American songwriters of all time, he was like in one of those bands that was neither Nirvana nor Blink 182 for that little bridging time between yeah. sort of 94 to 97 like area. And you know, Living Color, I mean, I gave up trying to play like Vernon Reid when I was 14 after 2 weeks of struggling at, you know, Cult of Personality and Open Letter to a Landlord. And
yeah, how do you emulate his style?
You just don't. Yeah. You don't. I mean,
dude's a monster.
Yeah, you kind of have to start over from scratch if you're going to play like that.
Right.
And watching him do it every night. And by the way, they are in the best shape of their lives. Like, those guys are running how to be a great band and great musicians clinic every night, you know.
That's
amongst
awesome.
Amongst the entertainment of it. And then Hoobastank is like, first night I watched their set, it was like about three dates in, we finally had our pack down and all that stuff, and I was watching Side Stage, and I was like, oh my God, I know every single one of these songs.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, it's incredible just, how many hits that band had.
Right, incredible. So it's like this super deep bench of just across the timeline, eclectic and sort of stable group of people who are soberly chipping away at being better at what they do. And it was so lucky and fortunate that Art reached out for us and gave us that chance. I just kind of felt like, I don't know, we're not used to that kind of gift, you know.
That's awesome. Yeah, Art's great. I have nothing but amazing things to say about him. We were on Capitol Records, Less Than Jake, with Everclear in the 90s. So
wow.
Got to play some radio shows with him. I've never met the Living Color guys. I'd love to. And we've done some shows with Hoobastank, and they were just amazing people as well. You know, the song Teenage Dirtbag, I'm careful when I choose words. I never want to offend someone on this show, but does this qualify as a novelty hit? Would you call it that? Sure.
And I
say that endearing because I've never had a novelty hit. I would love to have a novelty hit. And
well, so here's the thing. Like, I mean, first of all, if you told like 10 or 11 year old me when I was like trying to play Angus Young the best I could and just dancing around the living room looking in the mirror, seeing if I had the moves right and the fingering right, you know. If you'd have told me that I get to do any version of this when I'm an adult, I would have signed up. Yeah, you know, naively perhaps, but I would have been fine with that. So
right.
whatever anybody wants to call it, I'm not precious. You know, like,
the only reason I use that term with this song, I've heard your other stuff. This really stands out. And I guess I'm just going to, a lot of times I'll save this question for later in the episode when we get deeper into the song, but I'm just going to ask you now. So did you know when you wrote it that it was something special, or was it just this song at that point?
I had a sense that it was a strong story. Like, the story arc is fictional to my life, you know, somewhat inspired by time and place of where I grew up, but mostly in its narrative is fictional. And I felt like it was this sort of Hollywood ending kind of thing, perhaps, or just even like a kind of Walt Whitman ending or something like that, like a resolve. But I also had been around a bit and been in and out of like three or four, I guess, bands that were just this close to a record deal and did some pretty serious touring. And I knew at that point that like that's not enough to cut the mustard, just because you have this thing that, you know, so what if people line up around the block in your home city and at Mercury Lounge and they, you know, they tell their friends about it and there's people there you don't know. None of that really means anything. I had seen that before, you know, as I'm sure you did.
Right.
So I was sort of a cynical kind of thinking carefully about it. And I had been, the most serious thing I had done prior to that was I was in a band called Hope Factory, which was, I was a lead guitar player, and I was taking my direction from the lead singer songwriter of that band. It's a good friend of mine still, a guy named Allie. And he's the first guy I ever met who had a complete vision. You know, he knew what the record needed to sound like. He had a strategy for the record labels. He was, you know, very dissect and rebuild in our rehearsals when it came to, we're going to do a showcase at Brownies or whatever. And I learned so much from that. And we actually got a management deal with in that band with Joan Jett and her management. And we hit the East Coast direct support for her on a few dates. And that was like the first, like, everybody rent a van and jump in the van and we'll take turns driving and all, you know, the first run. And I guess I was 22 or 21 when that was my first experience like hitting the road, and I was so socially awkward and sort of like scared of talking to her and all that stuff. But she was really nice and patient with us and gave
Joan's amazing.
Right. And her manager, a few years later, when I had Teenage Dirtbag finished, I kind of showed it to him and I said, what do you think? And he said, it's a maybe. It's a maybe, you know? And I was like, yeah, okay.
You're speaking of Kenny Laguna.
Yeah, Kenny Laguna, yeah, who's seen and done just about everything there is
right,
to do.
Right, right. But hey, he didn't shoot you down. He gave you a nice solid B-plus
no,
maybe.
No, he gave me the real shit, you know? He's a tough sort of like hard-knuckled manager from New York City, you know?
Right.
And he wasn't bullshitting me, which was kind of cool, you know.
So you kind of knew there was something here, and you know, when I think of a novelty hit, and I use that with the utmost respect in this song, because there's novelty songs that you're like, oh, that's cute, that's kitschy, and yeah, it's got all the bells and whistles, but it just they don't end up being hits. It's just it's kind of a throwaway song. It's over here, they missed the mark. There's so much in this song. And I remember when it came out, this song sparked so much conversation. People thought you were a girl at the end with the falsetto. I'm sure you've heard that. There's just the sound effects, the production of this song. There was a lot here. You know, there's elements here of everything that was happening in the 90s, but at the same time, nothing sounded like this song. To me, I mean, this particular track just stood out, and great novelty songs will do that. Nothing will sound. I mean, I hear a little bit of Weezer in here. I hear a little bit of Everlast in here. What was happening at the time? I hear like
interesting.
A little bit of Soul Coughing, a little bit of Everclear, but not those bands. If that makes sense, you
sure.
know, it had its own sound, and there's so much little things going on here that just adds up to what this monster of a song has become. 200,655,469 YouTube views as of last night. Congratulations, man. That's incredible. That's incredible.
Yeah. I wish I could like understand what that meant. I mean, I'm sure that you'd also don't, like, it's hard to qualify or quantify what that even means,
right?
Like, you know, because like some of my favorite songs of all, like one of my favorite records is the Soul Cages by Sting, right?
Okay.
Those singles don't have as many spins on YouTube as Teenage Dirtbag, which doesn't make any, like, that doesn't make any sense to me and makes me feel like YouTube plays are maybe not, like, you know, something to, like, judge your own, you know, whatever by. I don't even know. Position, I guess, is the word.
Well, you know, I could have went further and checked the Spotify plays to everything else, but I'll tell you something. I think it holds weight. I think that's an incredible benchmark. And this song, everybody knows it. Everybody knows this song. It was just, this was the biggest song of 2000 pretty much. And
right.
Without any further ado, if you don't mind, I'd like to jump into the song right now.
Sure, sure.
Break this puppy down. It's 4 minutes and 7 seconds. The beginning is a 7 seconds of a drum loop by itself. And then from the 7 second to the 10 second mark, there's a swell of a record scratching turntable sound as the band jumps in with acoustic guitars and bass over that same drum loop and the record scratching. Scratching. That takes us up to the 21 second mark where verse one starts and the record scratching drops out at this point.
Her name is Noelle. I have a dream about her. She rings my bell.
Her name is Noelle. I have a dream about her. She rings my bell. I got gym class in half an hour. Oh, how she rocks in Keds and tube socks.
Yeah.
well, Keds. Yeah. Keds. You wrote a hit single with Keds shoes.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, in the 80s when I grew up, that was like just my early tendencies, you know, girls who caught my eye, or even just people who caught my eye. I wasn't into like the fancy, like, or high heels or like that kind of like made me feel nervous or kind of like something. I like the sporty look, you know.
Okay.
I was like, that's like, okay, that's somebody I can be friends with and and you know, someone who'll maybe come and hunt turtles with me in the woods or something, you know. that was the vibe. It was like, where's the simple, like, sort of tomboy vibe happening, you know?
Okay, and who's Noel?
Well, I didn't know a Noel personally. The name was familiar to me because my little brother had been in grammar school with somebody who had that name, and I had never met that person or interacted with that person at all. That was just a good vowel motion, you know, the Keith Richards thing, the vowel movement, you know. That was like a perfectly suited name for that spot, you know.
Well, you know, I won't necessarily throw the record scratching turntable sounds as part of the novelty thing. That was going on a lot, especially in the late 90s, 2000s. You know, people were introducing that into not just rap but into rock songs. But the first little bells and whistles here of what I was talking about earlier, on the line, she rings my bell. There's a slight ding of a bell on the left speaker. And then there's just like this 80s sounding computer sound off to the right.
Yeah.
That kind of happens.
She rings my bell. I got you in class in hand.
Whose idea was that? Was that something that you or Phil or David?
Well, that was
that
was me, and it was a sort of these jokes write themselves kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Just having a bell on the word bell is like you know, it's so on the nose. I actually still have the bell is upstairs. You want me to go get it?
And you have the actual damn bell that's in this song?
I do. Here, hang on. I'll be right back.
All right.
Hey, everybody, don't you dare go anywhere. There's lots more Krista Makes a Podcast after these messages from our sponsors.
If you're a fan of fierce, honest, in-your-face rock music, check out Another Cheetah. Based out of Greensburg, Pennsylvania, Another Cheetah lives to plug in, turn up, and rock out.
Why do I destroy myself? You'd be much better off with someone else.
Another Cheetah, streaming now on Spotify, Apple Music, and wherever else you listen to music.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
And now, back to the show.
One of the versions, one of the sort of four demo versions of the song that we finished, I was at Phil's apartment, Phil Jimenez.
Uh-huh.
And it was the autumn, I think, of 97. And we were kind of putting together the version that had fake drums, right?
Okay.
Like we took a cue from Soul Coughing and began producing the record before we had a drummer with an MPC 2000, which was, you may or may not know, the ultimate hip hop production studio for the 90s, you know.
Yeah, that was the real deal.
Right, and the beginning of the song, we wanted it to feel like it went from sort of LL Cool J into like a Jeff Lynne production. Like that was the we wanted to come out of New York and into the world kind of thing. You know,
From LL Cool J to ELO.
Exactly. Or actually, when I say Jeff Lynne, I think I'm probably referring more to like the way he made Full Moon Fever sound.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that kind of stuff. So here we go. Here's the right. And I did it with the back of a butter knife exactly this way. So it's like this little bell tree. And I'm pretty sure it's this one right here. The third one from the smallest. That's it right there. So I'll see if I can get a clean strike for you here. Yeah,
That sounds like it to me. That is awesome.
That's the actual one.
Is it safe to say, Brennan, that you're a pack rat?
I am a pack rat. You can see this is This is but a sliver.
He's got the damn bell from 25 years ago, and you should see what's behind this guy.
Yeah. So, like, Phil, it was
like Sanford and Son.
Yeah, right, exactly. Definitely. I'm definitely a junkyard rat.
I respect it. Cheers to you.
Yeah, I mean, I build, you know, when you record drums, you make baffles so that there's no snare bleed and hi-hat bleed. I make that out of stuff I found in the trash, literally, always, you know. Oh, look at this piece of rubber that somebody's throwing out. I could put a microphone behind that, you know. So,
hey, Bob, you going to throw out that doormat anytime soon?
Exactly. Don't get to talking to my band about that, because they have much to say.
Yeah, I have one in my band. My Rogers R. Packrath. You guys would get along famously. You never stop talking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing the bell with us. Moving on here. You know, I'm calling this next part the pre-chorus because it happens a couple times and the melody kind of changes here.
I'm glad you're using that term. You know who else is into that term? Max from Eve 6 is really into the
term. I had Max on the show recently.
Yeah. He and I had discussions of pre-choruses, and we decided that that's a way to make it so that the song has no bad parts.
I like it. Well, you know, this is a pre-chorus to me, even though it's the same progression. I'm considering this the pre-chorus setup, okay? Because it sets up the chorus perfectly.
Two socks, but she doesn't know who I am.
But she doesn't know who I am, and she doesn't give a damn about me.
So it's almost the same progression. It goes to a minor. It goes to a C sharp minor there for a substitution on the E, and then back to the A, and then back to the B. So you're right, but for the minor substitution. Yeah.
Gotcha. At the 46 second mark, we hit the first chorus, and this is when the real drums come in, along with distorted stereo guitars. But these don't sound like electric guitars. They almost sound like they're still acoustics filtered through like some kind of fuzz pedal or distortion.
So
what am I hearing here?
That's exactly correct. So, first I should say that it's a real drum kit that goes throughout the entire song, right?
Okay.
Yeah, and we worked and found a loop from the, I don't know if you remember the Wall of Vinyl series of sample-free, license-free loops that were available in the 90s.
I do. I never had them, but I'm familiar with what you're talking about.
So if you were to listen to this stuff, you'd hear it all over Biggie Smalls records and the Rockefeller stuff. And it's basically, you know, it was a free library of really nice vinyl cuts and loops and things. Mm-hmm. We worked and worked to find a warping sort of vinyl-y sleigh ride that went right into the real drums. I can't even tell you how many of those things we listened to before we found it. But that one went into the real drums and made it sort of smooth. And then it's my brother playing the drums. He just opens the hi-hat and hits a cymbal shot in the chorus.
Yeah, the hi-hat gets nice and loud in the choruses.
Right.
'Cause I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby.
The guitar tones on this are unique. Nothing sounds like this. I haven't heard anything since that sounds like this track. You did a really good job here of having your own sound. Like I said, there was elements of other things in here. You can almost hear a little Weezer in parts and a little of this, but man, it had its own thing.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
Yeah, and so the stereo guitars are there. That hi-hat's open like you were talking about. And there's like this high-pitched, almost keyboard sound. I don't know if it's overtones from the acoustic guitars.
Yeah.
And they're at the end of each line where the guitar hook is. So it's like, because I'm just a teenage dirtbag baby, wow, now, 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 the guitar part. And there's like these dings.
Yeah, blip, blip, blip. Yeah, yeah.
Baby, yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag baby.
What is that?
That's the only part of the song that was done outside of our home studio. For some reason, we were trying to mix it somewhere else on an experimental trip, and which didn't work out. But that keyboard line was laid down on an old Akai, one of the kind that you could sample. And you know what it was? It was DMTF, which is dual mode tone frequency. I think I might be getting that wrong, but that's what the telephone company uses as their coding sound. Okay. Have you ever heard of those? Have you ever heard of guys who, you know what phone freaking is? The original, this is very fascinating. You can go down a rabbit hole, but guys,
I know what it was to me as a teenage kid in 1989. But.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So you usually like whistle, if you whistled tones down the phone, you could open up all kinds of like passageways. You were basically hacking with sound,
yeah.
Right? Well, those tonalities were in a keyboard patch that was used on those little blips. And man, when we went to re-record it, was that a pain in the ass to retro engineer? Oh my God!
That's so crazy that that you flew that in after the fact. Which I want to ask you: was this recorded analog, or was this
No, no, it was recorded originally on DA-38 Tascam multi-track machines.
Okay,
and then we upgraded to the DA-78 multi-track machines.
Okay,
now, I mean this is a sort of a problem that we could discuss of the time because. You know, you guys came up in the same moment. It was like analog tape was getting really expensive, and all these new sort of ADAT based multi-track machines were coming online, and they were like transitional. Like that stuff was like for those 4 years, 96, 97, 98, 99, before Pro Tools came on.
And that's what we were recording on. That's,
right.
It was just like, it was the thing, and you could record over it, and you didn't have to worry about that, you know, because 2-inch tape was outrageously expensive.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we were determined to figure out how our own record sounded, because frankly, I didn't know what to, if Andy Wallace rocked up and was ready to help us, I wouldn't have known what to tell him. Like,
right.
You know, like I wouldn't have known how to verbalize it. So we had to spend some time in the shed, you know?
That sound was really barking at me. I'm like, what is that? And that's so cool. I'm going to read the chorus lyrics here because I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Listen to Iron Maiden, baby with me. Ooh, ooh, the ooh, ooh, oohs at the end. Ooh, 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 ooh. That's hard to talk. You have to sing it.
Yeah.
That ooh at the end is the first time that we hear a harmony in this song. And do you recall ever wanting to put harmonies anywhere else on this chorus part?
No.
Or were they all just there?
No, I wanted her, meaning the Noelle character, the Noelle voice in the song, to sort of give you a hint that she was going to be there at the tag of every chorus, you know, just kind of like set it up a little bit.
Okay.
And that was the move there, but it was like trying to be subtle about it, trying to be like do that voice a little bit here, a little bit there, and then introduce, you know.
It's perfect. It's the way this song builds and that there's just a harmony there, it's perfect. At the very end here, the drums go, the snare does this double time thing for one measure before verse two starts with that guitar riff. And then the reintro happens. It's the same as the top of the song with the record scratching. What I'm calling the drum loop is back, kind of all breaks down. And then the scratching disappears again when verse two starts at the minute and 17 second mark.
Her boyfriend's a dick, and he brings a gun to school and he'd simply kick my ass if he knew the truth. He lives on my block and he drives a Nyrock, but he doesn't.
Her boyfriend's a dick and he brings a gun to school and he'd simply kick my ass if he knew the truth. He lives on my block and he drives an Nyrock. Now, a couple things here. I know this was around the time of Columbine. Record labels were getting really sensitive with lyrics. Was Gunn, because every version I found online, was Gunn, did that actually make the record or was that bleeped out?
No. So I've heard told tales that there was an uncensored CD version somewhere. But I know that there was this sort of hubbub about, and you'll remember that Kmart selling records was this new thing that was such a big deal, and everybody at the label wanted to make sure they didn't screw up that relationship, so they were like...
That's where you got your Keds, right?
Yeah, right. And the socks. It was a deal. It was like a two-for.
Yeah, but, Blue Light Special.
So everyone was sort of paranoid about pissing off the big retailer, you know?
Sure.
So they were insisting on clean versions. Well, when it came, and I didn't mind. I was always a fan of hip-hop records getting played on the radio here in New York, Hot 97, where it was like the daytime, the you know, the Curses World record scratched out. And I just thought that was cool. Everybody did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was ready to accept that fate. But they wanted me to re-sing that one. they were kind of like trying to get under the hood and change the song.
As labels do, and kind of understandably so at that point, because things were very sensitive and, you know, people just, labels didn't want to get sued. That had a lot to do with it. I love the line, "He lives on my block and he drives an IROC," because, again, there's these elements of this song that all add up to making this a hit single. I just remember people talking about this song. There was so much to talk about. Here's another example. In the left speaker on "He Lives on My Block," there's a car starting up. And then on the line right after, "And he drives an IROC," at that moment, there's a car peeling out that starts in the right speaker, and then it kind of zooms over and swirls in your head to the left where the car crashes.
"He lives on my block, and he drives an IROC, but he doesn't."
Was that on the original demo, or was that
that
post?
Was in from very early on.
It was.
We wanted to set that scene and create, give that visual sort of distraction, because, you know, there's that heavy lyric at the top of the song, which is really close to home for me. And then, or rather, at the top of that verse, I should say. And then we wanted a little bit of sort of like a Bugs Bunny moment toward the end of the verse, you know, just get a little levity.
No, I think it's cool, you know, it right into pre-chorus two now. The lyric changes here. It's not "she," it's "but he doesn't know who I am. And he doesn't give a damn about me." And on that line, "he doesn't give a damn about me," following the chord progression, a B3 organ comes in just on that part.
"But he doesn't know who I am, and he doesn't give a damn about me, 'cause I'm just a teenager."
It's the threat of death. So in the first verse, "she doesn't know who I am" is sort of this somber, like, will I ever be noticed? And then the second verse, it's like, I hope he fucking doesn't notice, you know, like. so that's what that was. It's like a little church organ for the funeral if you actually get caught, you know.
And something else I haven't said yet, and I meant to talk about it earlier, is this song, and I don't mean this again in a negative way, it's annoyingly catchy. I know, you know that, you know, just the way the vocals delivered in the chorus, the way you're just kind of whiny about it, and it's just, you're this teenage dirtbag, and it's got this, just this quality about it that it is annoyingly catchy. It's just, it's an earworm, man. It really is.
Well, thanks. And I should say that means a lot coming from you, but the fact is, I kind of wanted the song to be weaponized in the sense that we wouldn't have to explain ourselves. We wouldn't have to have a strategy meeting or like any of that stuff. I wanted it to like answer all those questions and go do all the work, you know,
I mean, you know, I've done a number of episodes here dissecting songs and just thinking of all the songs I've heard my whole life, you know, being a professional musician the last 30 years, doing what I do, seeing different bands. I mean, there's something really unique about this track. It's not many other songs that sound like it. It's definitely got its own thing. At the 1:43 mark, we're at chorus number two. I'm calling it the real drums kick in again. The hi-hat gets real loud here. I know the real drums are always there.
Well, we unmute the room mics, you know.
There you go. So but it really did sound like it was a loop before. It didn't really sound like it was just an unmuting thing.
So that's an interesting. So back
you
when
did
we
a good
did,
job there.
Yeah, when we were concocting the version of it that was done on the MPC 2000, we went deep on that thing. We created a swing. We created a specific swing where the beat was a little longer toward the end of the bar than it was at the beginning. We really tinkered with how that drum sample version needed to feel. And you could do all that on that MPC 2000. So when my brother came and joined the band, we were like, learn this swing. This is a hip-hop swing in the verse. It's got to stabilize that way. And then it kicks off into AC/DC land in the chorus, but you got to be LL Cool J in the verse. Yeah. So that was what we were doing. It was on purpose, entirely on purpose. And I'm glad that you think it sounds like a loop, because it's just my brother playing the song.
No, it's cool. And those are really interesting conversations. We got LL Cool J, we got AC/DC, we got Iron Maiden, we got Jeff Lynne so far. You know, this is a cast of characters happening here. The chorus two is the same as chorus one lyrically, because I'm just a teenage dirtbag baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag baby. Listen to Iron Maiden, baby with me. Then the oohs happen with the harmony. There's a slight drum buildup on the floor and the toms here. And at the 2:05 mark, what is kind of a bridge, but I'm calling this the post-chorus. And this is my favorite part of the song. This is where I remember hearing this on the radio. I'm like, okay, the other part's the chorus, but this is the hook. This is the real thing here. And there's harmonies on all four of these lines, which lift this part. Oh yeah, dirtbag. No, she doesn't know what she's missing. Oh yeah, dirtbag. No, she doesn't know what she's missing. And the on she doesn't know what she's missing, there's this killer descending guitar riff that's happening with it.
Right.
That just is just another hook in this song that adds up to being the hit that it is. It's just all these little parts. It's hook after hook and the way the song's arranged. I also like that there's tambourine on all the snare hits here. That really seems to get loud in that part, but this part's great.
Yeah. So we had tambourines and shakers throughout. We call that section of the song the oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we sound check with it, because if we dial in the set for that as the focal point, everything else is kind of going to be okay, you know?
Okay.
And we've rolled up in festivals where, you know, nobody knows we're playing on this stage, and we get a little line check in front of the crowd, and we just count in at one, oh yeah. And within the next minute and 30 seconds, there's a crowd there because they can hear from the other side of the field and all that stuff. We did that to the Backstreet Boys one time. But
that's a great idea for, like, you know what? We're going to take our biggest hit, the best part of the song, soundcheck. We'll make sure we get all the asses from stage one over to stage two real quick.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm sure you have some version of that trick.
No, we don't, but I'm going to steal it. It's amazing.
Go for it.
It's amazing. That is awesome.
It is like you said. It's like, okay, well, we have a chorus that is kind of an earworm. What can we elevate? Can we put something better in the song that comes after the chorus?
The guitars change here too. It's the same kind of fuzz tone, but it almost sounds like something else is there. Maybe a chorus or a flange. Something else kind of happens. It sounds like to me.
So there were two guitars on the record. There's my Martin, which is the acoustic that's in the video, and I used that for the electric guitar sounds you hear in the song. And then I have my friends at the guitar shop I used to work at rebuilt me a Baystate parlor guitar from the 1890s that sounds really crackly and has sort of that James Taylor Fire and Rain, like, delicate sort of thing. And that's the one you hear in the verse. And for the first time, what you're noticing in the song is that they're both there at the same time in the oh yeah section. And they're these sort of big,
great,
sweeping, like open chords where it's no longer sort of metal palm muted anymore. It's just big, open. Yeah.
It's great. At the 2:26 mark, the acoustic guitar is just that kind of two-string plucking verse part comes back in for a half measure by itself, and then we're in what is verse 3, which is just the guitar and vocal for this whole time. And it seems, you know, like on paper here, you're looking at it, it's like it's a lot of lyrics, it seems like a long time, but it just brings everything back down for what happens at the end, which we're going to get to. But verse 3 is...
Man, I feel like mold. It's prom night and I am lonely. Lo and behold, she's walking over to me. This must be fake. My lip starts to shake. How does she know who I am? And why does she give a damn about?
Man, I feel like mold. It's prom night and I am lonely. Lo and behold, she's walking over to me. This must be fake. My lip starts to shake. And I'm calling it a pre-chorus 3. How does she know who I am? And why does she give a damn about? You never say me there. It just says, why does she give a damn about? Because the next part comes right in. But kind of set up these lyrics here for me. What's kind of happening here towards the end of the song?
Well, this is pure nerves, right? Because there's, like, I remember this from when I was a kid. If somebody who never paid attention to you is suddenly paying attention to you, you might just be about to get your ass kicked. right? So yeah. So like that was real danger, you know. So I mean
and I can relate.
Yeah, the nervous tension building there is looking at either maybe it'll be verse 1 or maybe it'll be verse 2. Like we don't know which one is going to be the way that this ends. And you know, for her to interrupt that paranoid, you know, jitters kind of moment, it was the only solution. You know,
yeah.
it was the only way, unless the boyfriend is there with a gun. It was the only way to get out of Dodge with a happy ending. You know,
okay.
So it was like, what are we gonna do? And I guess there's an alternate universe where it doesn't end well. but
you know. I think you and I were at the same sock hop.
Yeah, probably.
Both standing against the wall awkwardly. Hey, yeah, you're gonna piss in the punch, or you want me to? I'm calling this chorus 3 here, Brendan.
Okay.
But it changes. The chord progression is the same, but the guitars here go to 8th notes. And it's just kind of this breakdown. It gets almost sludgy, like kind of heavy, not on purpose, but just, I think just the way the guitars are played and the way they're laying in the track. And this is where the vocals are falsetto here. And they're in stereo now, the vocals,
right,
this falsetto
right.
part. And it's such a cool effect to have it, have the vocal happening in the right and the left speaker, almost with whatever effects on it. It kind of makes it sound like they're not in sync, but even though they are.
I've got 2 tickets to Iron Maiden, maybe. Come with me Friday, don't say maybe. I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby, like you.
Ooh. And the lyric is, I've got 2 tickets to Iron Maiden, baby. Come with me Friday, don't say maybe. And on the maybe here, that same 80s computer sound happens again right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
the phone call. Well, yeah, I mean, you'll recall the time of like calling your friends on the phone and having phone numbers memorized and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of like the digits, you know, like, are we going to talk to each other on the phone? That certainty of when you're calling a friend or even a first girlfriend or something like that.
Okay.
You remember how it sounds, you know. You remember the song that it makes.
Well, and the last 2 lines here, I'm just a teenage dirtbag baby like you. And then the oohs come in, the ooh, 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 with a harmony on the oohs. And this whole, these 4 lines here, it sounds like there's an organ or a keyboard behind it.
Yeah, happening, really happening thick as organ well. Pad.
Yeah, it's
from,
cool.
From an old realistic Radio Shack keyboard that we had.
You know, everything you've talked about, from the gear to the influences to how you ran these acoustics through the, you know, the preamps that you were doing, that's why this song sounds so unique, man. You're a gear nerd, and that's why this song sounds like it does, man. I'm serious. It's really cool that you captured this because of everything that you did to put into it. That's why it sounds like what it does, and why no song has ever sounded like it.
Thanks, man. Yeah, like I said, we from 95 until 99, I re-recorded the song a couple times in like sort of 4-track demo. And then once I started working with Phil sometime around late 96, 97, we did 2, really like 2.5 new versions. And the final one was March of the year 2000 at my mother's house, where we replaced all of our MPC drums with my brother and re-recorded some of the parts because we were not quite there on them yet. And that final version is from my mom's house.
And this is so great to hear, Brennan, because so many times on the show we've heard that, you know, a lot of the biggest hits were just, oh, that was written in 5 minutes. This is an example of a song that was kind of labored over production-wise. It was really thought of for a number of years, and it still became the monster that it became. That is really cool.
Yeah, it was certainly overthought. You're right about that. I mean, like, because
a lot of times that doesn't act equal to a hit single, though. It'll
yeah,
just be overcooked,
yeah.
And the idea never goes anywhere. You know that.
I was aware of that threat. I also knew that that this thing that I was hearing that was equal parts Paul Simon and James Taylor and equal parts Metallica and, you know, AC/DC, If You Want Blood, You Got It. I didn't know how to do that, and I hadn't heard anything that did that yet. And also to have this sort of stability on the floor of the rhythm that you keep mentioning that was straight out of New York hip hop, you know, Public Enemy and Tribe Called Quest and the stuff that I was listening to, and a band like Soul Coughing, who, you know, was like this experimental New York sort of jazz thing that had hip hop pieces and samples.
Yeah,
and
what an interesting band.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult hybrid to come to. So it was taken apart and rebuilt several times. Yeah.
That's great. Well, after the ooze here with the harmony, the drum buildup with that, you know, guitar riff that runs throughout the song, the running theme, we're in what I'm calling the post-chorus. It's the outro here, and it's the "Oh Yeah, Dirtbag" that we heard earlier. No, she doesn't know what she's missing. Oh yeah, dirtbag. No, she doesn't know what she's missing. The distorted guitars and the, I'm calling the real drums, kick in for this part. I love on "Oh Yeah" on the first or the third line here, "Oh Yeah," the melody changes on that one just slightly. I just think it's killer. And then you go high on "Dirtbag" on that line. You go up on the bag, and it just kind of just, it's just something else that lifts this song at the very end here. The band goes on for about two measures, and it kind of ends with this classic rock ending, but it almost feels like it falls apart at the same time.
Yeah, we wanted that to really start to feel like we came off of the grid. You know?
Yeah, that's exactly what it feels like.
So we literally turned the click off for those last few measures where we're doing the da chugga da da chugga da da.
Yeah,
that's actually the verse. So we're playing the verse in a way that is like betraying its metal roots and kind of like this up chug thing from straight out of like Helmet or Quicksand, some of the bands that I was into in the early 90s, post hardcore. Kind of New York City music, or even Bad Brains or something, you know, like that sort
yeah,
of like
that's awesome.
Just giving it that root back again so that we could just destroy it and be done, you know.
Kinda. That's cool. Well, for the listeners, I want to let you know we got something really special right now. Brendan has agreed to pull out the old acoustic and right. do a little so, off the cuff rendition here for
so
us.
So here's the question. Now you must choose, okay?
Okay.
So I have the original Bass State parlor guitar that's 130 years old upstairs. That's
oh,
the one
man.
I did the verses. That's the acoustic sound.
Okay.
Or I can do it with the one from the video. That is the one I recorded the choruses with. But it's an acoustic performance. So this is going to be, you have to decide.
You got to do the 1890 guitar for me.
Okay.
You got to.
All right.
I got to hear that verse guitar.
All right. I'll go get it. Hang tight.
All right.
Okay, so let me see if I can get this mic into a decent position here. I'm sure that we can. Okay, let me tune this ancient relic.
Go for it.
So when we re-recorded the song, the new master, Teenage Dirtbag 2020, which is on Spotify right now, I was fortunate enough to still have this thing, and it still works. So we actually were able to get back to where we started on that acoustic sound, which would have been, frankly, I don't know how it could have happened if we hadn't had this.
Yeah. When you just strummed it, I heard it, man. I know that's the guitar. It's
yeah. So yeah. So this is it. It's this tiny little thing. It's kind of beautiful and beat up. But I'm gonna lay this mic down so it sounds relatively similar to the other mic. Let's see if I can do this. Okay, so I won't be able to hear you for a moment, but here we go.
All right.
Her name is Noelle, and I had a dream about her. She rings my bell. Got gym class in half an hour. Oh, how she rocks in kids and two socks. But she doesn't know who I am, and she doesn't. I rock. But she doesn't know who I am, and she doesn't give a damn about me, 'cause I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Listen to Iron Maiden, baby, with me.
Was the mix okay?
The mix was great. Dude, absolute bravo to you. I had goosebumps the whole time. I am completely honored that you did that just now. It was so cool. I can't believe how high your voice still is. You sound exactly like you did 20 years ago. It's awesome.
Oh, thanks, man.
I wish I could play guitar and sing at the same time like you do with that feel. It's just so good, man. It's so good. Oh. Thank you.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for doing such a weird deep dive. I love this kind of stuff. It's so fun to talk to another person who writes and does, you know, music, and like, I don't know, it's just very, very sort of purposeful, and thank you for that.
Thank you. And you know, I love doing this podcast. My producer Chris, whom you know, Wheatus has done a UK tour with Punchline back in the day. I guess I just found that out. And you know, Chris had suggested me doing this about a year ago, and I can't tell you what it's done for me musically. I've discovered another love of music again. Not that it ever went away, but just being able to break down other people's songs, I've learned so much. You know. And just being able to have this connection with somebody, it's like, I'm going to go back and dive into your catalog. You're such an interesting songwriter, and you know, I have a new favorite band again. This is it's cool. Well, I get to kind of dive into someone else's career, and man, that was such a great performance. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. I mean, like, you know, now so late in our lives and in our career and everything, to have people, because, like, you know, when we first started touring, you guys, like, that was a big deal to even be in the same room that you guys were in. It felt like we were getting somewhere and all that stuff. And to be in touch with you this way is really, like, kind of like, I'm a little starstruck, to be frank. Like, and I know Matthew, our bass player, you know, has been to see you a bunch of times. And, like, I feel like it really feels very sort of like an arrival of some kind just to be able to talk to you like this. So really much appreciation. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for saying that. I wish you nothing but continued success. And I'd like you to leave the listeners now with whatever's going on with Wheatus coming up. What's happening?
So to my surprise, we're hitting the road again September 7th with another leg of the Summerland Tour, Everclear, Hoobastank, Living Color. And we're coming through, a whole bunch of dates just got posted, and there's talk of it happening again later in the year, perhaps. In addition to that, we're finishing up this record. Like I said, the re-record of our first album is cool. the 10 songs from the original cut, but another 10 additional tracks from over the years, songs that kind of sounded like they belonged on album one, and that's why we didn't do them. You know? Once pandemic is cleared up and this touring is over, we're going to finish that up. I'm shooting for Christmas 2021 for the big release on those 20 tunes. But Teenage Dirtbag 2020 is, and a bunch of other tracks from that selection, 8 songs to be exact, are all currently on Spotify, so you can check out those new ones. And there's a movie that we're making. A couple of kids in the UK started following us around on tour and back in 2010, and they came up with a documentary. They got pretty deep on the whole thing. It's called Wheatus, You Might Die, and it's a feature-length documentary that's in the works, and we're just trying to finalize again with all sorts of COVID caveats. But
gotcha.
But and just going out on the road again with Art and Doug and Corey and Vernon and all those guys in those bands that we look up to so much. It's just, I can't believe it's about to happen again in less than a month. So we're so stoked, you know.
That's great. Well, if you get a chance, tell Art and the Hoobastank guys that I said hello, please.
Yeah, I will do. I will do. Thank you.
Hey, everybody, don't touch that dial. There's plenty more Krista Makes a Podcast after a few words from our sponsors.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.
Hey, do you have an idea for a podcast but don't know where to start? Or do you have an already existing podcast that you want to take to the next level? Well, check out WeKnowPodcasting.com. From concept development to theme music to editing to logos, WeKnowPodcasting.com is a one-stop shop for all things pod. Don't hesitate to hit us up. We're very nice.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song via MP3 only and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured band is Glazed from Jacksonville, Florida. They describe themselves as a pop punk band, but I think there's a lot more here to them than just that. Really cool sound. They're going to be playing the Fest this year in Gainesville, Florida, so make sure to check them out there. Here's a snippet of their song, Cheeseburgers.
Work. I can panic club perform, but poison always picks a perfect storm.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Man, I was super excited for that episode, just as I know everybody is going to be super excited for that episode, because, Chris, Teenage Dirtbag is seriously in my lifetime, one of the most beloved songs, and not just by people that like punk rock music or pop music. I'm talking everybody I know loves that song. And one thing that makes that clear is if you take a look at some of the artists over the years that have covered that song, SZA covered that song, Phoebe Bridgers covered that song, All Time Low covered that song, One Direction covered that song. It is just loved by everybody. And I don't know, when you talk to Brendan, you kind of see why. He kind of covered all the bases.
Yeah, and it's just a unique track. It's unique. I use the word novelty, which I'm always careful to use words like that because I never want to cheapen somebody's hit song or not a hit song. I don't want to say a word that cheapens it, but I meant it with sincerity. This song is very unique. Everything about it, from using a guitar from 1890 on the verses and changing the guitars for the chorus, but not bringing electric guitars, still using acoustics and running them through these crazy old preamps with just, he's a musical nerd in the sense that he just loves gear and loves weird stuff and all the influences that he threw into this track. It's the sum of its parts and nothing quite sounds like it.
Yeah, it's very unique, very original. Chris, I do a podcast about one-hit wonders, so believe me when I tell you that I have done my due diligence when it comes to novelty music and what makes a novelty song. And when you said that, I was kind of like, you know what? I'm going to argue with Chris about that a little bit in the rap because I know what you're getting at. And the dictionary style definition of that is a song that's built upon some form of novel concept, such as a gimmick, a piece of humor, or a sample of popular culture. Now, I think in a way, you do have all of those elements. Not the gimmick, I don't think the song is gimmicky, but you do have him playing the role of both the guy and the girl in this story. So you have that part, and you have the humor in the lyrics, and you do have that sample of popular culture, whether it be the IROC or the Keds or whatever. So I do think you're valid in saying that. But when you look at like the history of novelty music, I feel like Brendan would gladly be put in a category with someone like Weird Al. But he's way less in a category of someone like Lou Bega and Mambo Number 5, which is a novelty hit.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
You know, novelty hits are they're something I didn't bring up in the episode. They're a sign of the times. It's something that's happening now. That wasn't so much what I was getting at with this, I'm glad you brought that up because I think I was a little off the mark. But there was something about this song that was almost unbelievable, that the singer was playing the role of both the male and the female in it, and there was something almost like, is this real? Like, the first time I heard it, I was like, what is this? Is this like, it just seems like so out there as a song, but it fit in perfectly with what was happening in the late 90s, early 2000s. It sounded like a lot of the bands I mentioned in the episode, but it didn't sound like one in particular. It kind of took all these different influences and I don't know. It's like you said, it's been covered by so many bands and everybody knows this song. You know, he kind of scoffed at the 200 million YouTube views, but I don't know. To me, that's pretty impressive.
You know, this song brings about like something I've been thinking about a lot lately is a lot of time hit songs have something that just grabs you about them, something like almost outlandish about them, you know, and you brought up the point that this doesn't sound like a lot of other Weedus songs, that this song even sticks out as a Weedus song. Who Weedus has some pretty wild songs. They have a song I love called Lemonade. I don't know if you know that song, but you should really check that song out too. Amazing song.
Remember the way it was when I was home before I left you all alone. Now I'm 80 on the porch drinking lemonade with you, and that is all that I can think about when you tell me that you cheated. 80 on the porch drinking lemonade with you, and that is all that I can think about when you tell me that you cheated on me.
I knew that you would.
But this song, yeah, the way he sings it so high, and then you have all those little sound clips, those things of like the car noises,
yeah,
and the little samples. And I was thinking when you were talking about that, have we had a song yet so far on this show that had that as an element of it? I don't know if we have.
Yeah, there was, I can't think off the top of my head. I know there was some samples, but not like this. This was what, you know, kind of gives it its own personality, this song. And I even brought it up in the episode. And again, I was treading lightly. I didn't want to offend Brendan, but this song's annoyingly catchy, which a lot of hit songs are. And his vocal delivery, it makes you, you know, the first time I heard it, I was like, you know, it's almost the guy, which he is. He's the nerdy guy at prom. He's not fitting in. It's like, and you're hearing him singing this whiny voice. And I'll tell you, when he performed acoustic, he sounds just like he did 20 years ago. That voice, I'm thinking he's going to do it in another key. He did it in the original key on the guitar from the 1890s, that guitar that was used on the original recording. That was so cool.
Dude, I was going to say that maybe when you heard this song for the first time or in the early years, you would have just assumed that if that wasn't a female doing that part, that they just pitched it up.
For sure.
And to sit here and watch him and listen to him nail that, it's incredible. It's seriously incredible. And I loved when he said that they wanted the song to be weaponized. They wanted the song to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And it does on every level. It is hook after hook after hook after hook. And on top of that, man, the story.
Well,
could you not love the story in this song? The story is so relatable. I've talked about this to you before. It's universally relatable. It gives you chills. It's such a nice
story.
I'll
tell you something else I love, Chris, is that this is one of those rare times that a song has been cooked this long. He started messing with this thing in 1997, you know, about 4 years prior to the release in 2000, 3 or 4 years, and just kept demoing it and kept trying different things with it and doing rewrites. And that we rarely hear that, you know. If it has been belabored over a song, the producer will have something to do with it, or the band members, and they'll cook it a little too long. But usually it's like, oh, this song was written in 5 minutes, and this one was put a lot of time in. And he said that at some point it was a concern of his, but ultimately in the end he believed in the song.
I think that we're about 70 episodes into this podcast now, and this isn't putting down any other song. And yeah, there is merit in those songs that are written in 5 minutes or whatever. I think Teenage Dirtbag is the most well thought out song from a songwriting perspective and a production standpoint of any song we've done. It seems like it's the most labored over, and so much love was put into it and so much thought was put into it. A great band, all great people. I can't say enough great things about Wheatus. Amazing episode.
And speaking of amazing, Chris, I don't know if everybody out there knows, but you do animated videos as well as lyric videos. You can do picture video collage montages for bands, for fans, for people that get custom songs from me. So tell people where to reach you if they like any of the above.
Thanks for the plug, Chris. If you'd like to reach me, you can hit me up at chrisfafalius@gmail.com. That's chrisfafalius@gmail.com. That is my personal email address. Yeah, I guess it's C-H-R-I-S, F as in Frank A, F as in Frank A, L-I-O-S as in Sam @gmail.com. That's what I always have to do to people on the phone when I'm spelling my last name, because F's and S's sound a lot alike on the phone. But just hit me up.
So they don't have to have Apple for A or Alpha for A?
No, I think they can figure out A. It's the F's and S's that get confused. I got a lot of F's and S's in my name, but chrisfafalius@gmail.com is how you can reach me.
Yeah, people they'll hit me up thinking that I put these things together. I don't do much in the way of video, but Chris is your man. If you would like his help, he's there for you. Once again, chrisfafalius@gmail.com. And please, please, please give me a follow on Instagram. I'm still 6,000 followers shy of Roger from Less Than Jake. I can't even believe this. It's like 2 years later. It's exactly 6,000 what it was 2 years ago. My ego is bruised. You can reach me on Instagram at @lessthanchrisd. And I want to thank this week's guest. So much fun, man. I totally couldn't believe what went into this song. I can't say enough about it. I want to thank Brendan B. Brown from Wheatus for sitting in with us this week, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.
Hey, you. Do you have any plans this year? Ha!
How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends, Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-d.com, soundtalentmedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.